Hello there. Today is Wednesday, May 25th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, U.S. Allied forces launch an operation to liberate an Islamic State group stronghold. Bernie Sanders digs in while Donald Trump digs up an old conspiracy theory. President Obama takes on sensitive human rights issues in Vietnam. Comedian Bill Cosby will stand trial on sex assault allegations.
Mr. Cosby's interview with the police in the police report that was admitted into evidence was very damaging to him.
Also ahead, why more and more millennials living with their parents and not a romantic partner. It's all here on today's International Edition, and we begin with the U.S. presidential campaign. Presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump is getting personal again, targeting former President Bill Clinton in an attempt to undermine his wife Hillary Clinton. And while Mrs. Clinton is taking swipes at Trump, she's also having to contend with Bernie Sanders. In the span of 1 year, Sanders has gone from 40 points down in polls to having near equal presence with Hillary Clinton as the Democratic Party shapes its platform of policies at its convention in July. And he's still hoping for a win in the very last and biggest primary state, where he continues to campaign hard.
And I believe that if we win here in California, and if we win the other five states that are up on June 7th, we're going to go marching to the Democratic Convention with a hell of a lot of momentum.
Now let's talk more about it with VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Hillary Clinton is close to having the delegates she needs to clinch.
That's right. I mean, Hillary Clinton sees herself as the presumptive Democratic nominee, but ask Bernie Sanders and he'll give you a very different answer. This week already, he has talked about the issues he wants on the Democratic platform at the convention this summer. And of course, we've learned that he is asking for a recount of votes in Kentucky. So for Bernie Sanders and his supporters, this primary election season, at least for the Democrats, is nowhere near over.
This must be really worrisome to the Clinton camp, who really want to take their aim over to Donald Trump.
Oh, absolutely. And they're already getting attacked by Donald Trump. So they really need to pivot over to that general election strategy so that they can start fighting him on some of these things. They do not need to be worried about Bernie Sanders in their rearview mirror.
But they he's there. And it sounds like he made some comments this week. Could be a messy convention.
Right. No, he has certainly said, he's said as late as these past few days, that the Democratic National Convention will be a fight. And he intends to go all the way. Previously, he said that he would wait until the very last voters have their say, which is California, on June 7th. And now it appears that he will have his say at the Democratic National Convention.
What happens if he wins California?
He's still so far behind that he can't mathematically catch up with Hillary Clinton. I think, you know, perhaps there's an argument still simmering among his supporters about the superdelegates and whether they're fair or not, and if that gives the people a say in the election. That could be his argument as well if he does really well in California.
And on the Republican side, there was a pro-Hillary Clinton PAC that came out with an ad targeting Trump. And boy, is he coming back now fighting. I mean, the mudslinging is already starting.
Right. We've heard that the 90s are back, and they are, in a way, through the Clintons. Trump is calling back to some of the old scandals and, you know, slurs and mudslinging that we saw happen when Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton's husband, was president in the 90s. We're hearing about the rape allegations where he, you know, was with Juanita Broderick and Paula Jones, the sexual harassment suits, and all of these old things that are very interesting from a strategic standpoint to bring up, because the older voters will remember these battles from the 90s and in some respects will have already been through them and decided how they feel about the Clintons. And then the younger voters may see this as so far in the past that it's not really impacting them and their concerns. So I think it remains to be seen how well these Trump attacks will stick against Hillary Clinton.
And I know you were covering an event in Tennessee this past week with an interesting group of Trump supporters.
That's right. In my ongoing tour around the country talking to Trump supporters, This time my stop was in rural Tennessee with a group that likes to call themselves race realists. And from that standpoint, they believe that white Europeans need to preserve their culture against all sorts of different groups that are coming into the United States. And they very much like the message that Donald Trump has been sending out about immigration, about banning Muslims from this country, about deporting undocumented immigrants, about building a border wall. That definitely resonates with this group.
Would these people be classified as white supremacists?
So there are a couple of different groups like the Anti-Defamation League and the Southern Poverty Law Center, which monitored this type of discussion in the United States about race. And they've deemed this group a hate group. So by their standards, they are a hate group. Well, this group likes to call themselves a race realist group. So in a way, it's an interesting indication of where the discussion is in this country about race and how Donald Trump is moving some of these ideas farther into the mainstream.
All right. Thanks so much, Catherine. You can read much more on our website at voanews.com. Now let's check out what's trending online with our social media reporter, G. Abby Lee. Hi, G. I understand there's actually some talk about a new Pew Research study that has to do with millennials.
More millennials are living with their parents and with a romantic partner. For the first time in more than 130 years, American adults are more likely to be living with their parents as opposed to with a spouse or a partner. Specifically, we're talking about Americans aged 18 to 34.
Very interesting stuff. I know, you know, hard economic times can always lead to this.
That's right.
But how are people reacting to this?
Lori, I have to say, living with your parents as an adult is not viewed positively overall here in America, but that may be a totally American concept. Let's check out the most liked comment to Pew's Facebook post about the latest study. A man named Vishal wrote, "Moving out after you're a quote-unquote adult is really a Western thing. I don't know why there is such a stigma surrounding living at home. You can help your parents, they can help you. Communal living has a lot of benefits." The top comments were mostly about defending the growing trend of living at home. Another person wrote, "I've been criticized for it as if I never left, but I don't mind. I love spending time with my family and being able to help out when I can."
So what were some of the negative comments?
A user named Steven wrote that he lived on his own since he was 16 and his son when he was 19. He argued that being independent early on in life builds your character, and that invited a lot of interesting counterarguments. People were telling him to get informed about current macroeconomic situation and that the 70s were quite a different economic time.
Interesting. Well, gee, you grew up in Asia. How is all of this viewed there?
Actually, in many parts of Asia, living on your own before getting married suggests either you don't have a great relationship with your parents or that you're a bit of a hippie. It's actually viewed quite negatively, especially if you're the eldest child who is supposed to be taking care of your parents. Lori, back to you.
All right. Thanks so much, G. And you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. Also, follow the International Edition stream at VOA_IE. Some of the other stories we are following at voanews.com. U.S. lawmakers cast doubt on approval of the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. Families give DNA to help ID victims of the Egypt Air disaster. The U.S. will seek the death penalty for a white suspect in the South Carolina church massacre. The relative of a slain Taliban leader wants to claim his body. And a tragedy on Mount Everest highlights the plight of Sherpas. Find expanded coverage of these stories and much more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
I come here mindful of the past, mindful of our difficult history, but focused on the future.
President Barack Obama, in a forward-looking speech, has told the Vietnamese that they and the American people are embarking on a 100-year journey together.
With this visit, we've agreed to elevate our security cooperation and build more trust between our men and women in uniform. We'll continue to offer training and equipment to your Coast Guard to enhance Vietnam's maritime capabilities. We will partner to deliver humanitarian aid in times of disaster.
Monday, on his first visit to Vietnam, President Obama gave his hosts a gift they'd been hoping for, a total lifting of the U.S. embargo on sales of lethal weapons. VOA White House correspondent Cindy Sein is traveling in Southeast Asia with the president. Cindy, Tuesday's speech touched on a lot of different things, including the very sensitive issue of human rights.
Yes, that's right. The president said that there are basic rights enshrined in the Vietnamese Constitution, including freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of assembly. And he called on the Vietnamese government to open up the political process to candidates from outside the Communist Party.
So this was a pretty wide-ranging address at Hanoi's National Convention Center. I know there were about 2,000 people, including some Vietnamese government officials. Is that correct?
It was a very well-dressed crowd, probably vetted closely by the government. And they cheered loudly when President Obama appeared. And they also cheered when the president scolded China, not mentioning China by name, but saying larger countries should not bully smaller countries.
But yet there was dead silence when he talked about the issue of human rights.
That's right. There was no reaction, stony face reaction to that one.
I know the president also met with some Vietnamese civil society members saying there were significant areas of concern regarding political freedom, among other things.
Yes, that's right, Lori. The White House had insisted on that meeting, but unfortunately, there were some empty chairs and there were some prominent Vietnamese bloggers who were prevented from attending. And several prominent human rights groups and said that this is further evidence that Vietnam did not deserve to have the arms embargo lifted, that they're ongoing. The very fact that they're not allowing people to meet with President Obama while he's in the country shows that they are still not respecting basic human rights.
Do you think his speech will have any kind of long-term impact?
Well, it's hard to say, Laurie. I mean, as the president said, there is much progress, but then again, there is evidence that there are still ongoing human rights abuses. But the argument of the Obama administration is that by deepening ties and relations, the U.S. can have more impact on improving the human rights situation.
All right. Thanks so much, Cindy. Well, there are more than 100 political prisoners in Vietnam, and additional people have been detained in the past week, according to activists. Now to another part of the world. Kurdish-led Syrian Democratic Forces have launched an operation to capture areas north of Raqqa, the Syrian de facto capital of Islamic State, with the aim of eventually liberating the city. I talked about what's happening and how the U.S. is involved with VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden.
Earlier on Tuesday, the Syrian Democratic Forces announced that they were beginning an offensive to retake northern Raqqa, and it caused quite a bit of a stir because of the way they worded the statements that they put out and the statements that they put out on Twitter. It seemed to indicate that they were actually going after the Islamic State de facto capital of its self-declared caliphate, Raqqa itself, or the northern part of Raqqa. Reading the statement more carefully and listening to U.S. officials, it seems what the Syrian Democratic Forces are really doing, and remember, this is a combination of Kurdish YPG fighters and also Arab militias in Syria. What they're trying to do is clear out some of the area to the north of Raqqa, area that has been described as in some ways a wasteland, not very populated, but an area that Islamic State has been using to carry out attacks.
Does the U.S. have a hand in this, or are they just U.S. allied forces?
Well, the statement by the Syrian Democratic Forces said that coalition troops would be participating and fighting alongside them. The U.S. is not going anywhere near that statement. And if you talk to U.S. military officials, what they tell you time and time again is that the U.S. does not talk about special operations forces, of which they have a few hundred in Syria, many of them training these forces. In fact, just the other week, the commander of CENTCOM, the Central Command, which oversees U.S. operations in that part of the world, visited Syria and commented on how effective that training had been. So there's definitely a U.S. presence there. Whether or not these U.S. special operations forces will be fighting alongside the Syrian Democratic Forces unknown. The U.S. won't comment on it. Obviously, there's a lot of operational security at risk from the U.S. perspective. But by saying that, what the Syrian Democratic Forces are able to do is it's almost psychological operations. They're sending a message that it's not just us. It's also the U.S. And that may change the calculation by Islamic State fighters, commanders, on how they handle the situation. One thing the U.S. is doing and had been doing even with a couple of strikes the day before this announcement is hitting some of the areas that the Syrian Democratic Forces are targeting, places like al-Shaddadi and also north of Raqqa, where there are groups of Islamic State fighters that have positioned themselves where they're carrying out operations. So there is air power involved. The U.S. has consistently provided that along with other members of the coalition. The question is going to be, how ambitious is this campaign and how quickly do the Syrian Democratic Forces think they can advance? The other question is, given the territory that they seem to be looking at, that they seem to want to try to get control of, how desperately will Islamic State defend that territory?
What about Russia? What is Russia's role in all of this?
Well, there have been some talk of more U.S. cooperation with Russia floated by the Russians and several Russian officials. A U.S. military spokesman told VOA there is no cooperation with the Russians when it comes to retaking Raqqa. State Department has indicated that the U.S. is working a little bit more with Russia in terms of another part of Syria and the cessation of hostilities designed to put an end to the fighting between the regime led by Russian ally President Bashar al-Assad and some of the rebel groups.
All right, twofold question. You mentioned President Bashar al-Assad. It seems almost unheard of that anything could change as long as he is in power. Where does he fit into all of this? And secondly, who is the target here anymore? We talk about Islamic State, but we know that Syrian government forces are also allegedly responsible for mass deaths.
The way some U.S. officials have put it to me is that it's a mess there, and it's very complicated. And even within the coalitions that have built up in Syria, whether they're rebel coalitions or regime coalitions or the U.S.-backed allies, what it really comes down to, you have these two themes. On the one hand, you have the U.S., Russia, the U.N. trying to promote the cessation of hostilities, try to bring about a peaceful solution to the fighting that, from the U.S. point of view, eventually moves Assad out. From the Russian point of view, doesn't. From the Iranian point of view, mm-hmm. It doesn't. And then on the other hand, you have Russia verbally talking a lot about targeting terrorists and Islamic State. They've been doing more of that according to U.S. officials, but terrorist was a term they were using for anyone who was opposed to the regime. And you have the U.S. part of a campaign of backing groups on the ground and supplying air power both in Syria and in Iraq to dislodge, degrade, and eventually destroy Islamic State.
If there's anything left of Syria, I mean, we've already seen this mass exodus, and the human toll is just unimaginable.
It's staggering, and one of the long-term concerns you hear is what eventually happens. What is the balance of power that's left? And some of the concern that you hear even from Western analysts is what happens if you remove Assad from power? Is there anyone else there? And they're not saying that Assad is good or that perhaps what he's done isn't disastrous for his own people. But they say if you remove Assad from the equation, who takes his place? What power can there be?
All right. You can read much more of this story at voanews.com. At least four people have died on Mount Everest this week, three of them amateur climbers and one a Sherpa mountain guide. And he's not the first one. Dozens of Sherpas have lost their lives guiding foreigners to the summit of the world's tallest mountain since 1953, when British expeditioner Edmund Hillary and local Sherpa Tenzing Norgay made the first ascent on Everest. The son of the first Sherpa to reach the top is slamming the mountain climbing industry for exploiting Sherpas who risk their lives for a pittance. VOA's Penelope Pulu has the story.
Come back in. On April 18, 2014, filmmaker Jennifer Peedham of the documentary Sherpa captured the worst tragedy that has ever happened on Everest. 16 Sherpas, the native guides of Mount Everest, died in that avalanche. The film focuses on the dangers and hardship the Sherpas endure every climbing season for a fraction of the profit expedition associations and the Nepalese government make at their expense.
Roughing it on Mount Everest. Hot towels and tea in the morning.
And while the visitors are prepping for the climb in their spacious tents, the Sherpas pay their respects to the gods of the mountain, praying for a safe ascent while their families anxiously await their return. Doing anything at this altitude is risky and can be deadly, but lavish summit expeditions designed to make the climb less extreme are the very things that endanger the lives of climbers and Sherpas alike, says Norbu Tenzing Norgay.
My father said, I wish I had never climbed this mountain.
He is the son of Tenzing Norgay, the first Sherpa ever to climb Mount Everest.
Can we reduce that risk? Yes, you know, if people aren't carrying espresso machines and heaters and pads so that the clients can sleep comfortably. Yes, you can reduce the risk.
The documentary highlights the inequity and the cultural rift between the Sherpas, who see the climb as a pilgrimage, and the Westerners as a challenge. Despite the dangers, the Sherpas depend on the expedition business. Each makes about $5,000 a season, while their farming counterparts make $700 a year. But that amount pales next to the $70,000 or $100,000 each climber pays for the trip of his dreams.
Good morning, Dai.
Good morning, Mount Everest.
The lion's share goes to the businesses and the government, says Norbu Tenzing Norgay.
The average Sherpa now gets $15,000 in insurance should something bad happen, and that's up, $5,000 since 2014. But if you go back a number of years, when somebody died on Everest, the average Sherpa was able to build a house, send the kids through school, and have a tea house. And these days, the insurance barely covers the cost of a funeral.
According to the documentary, the April 2014 avalanche was the last straw.
16 people dying at the same time, it's a huge, huge shock. When it started to sink in, the anger got distinctly pointed at the government. They feel that the government has always been benefiting off the labor of the Sherpas, the lives of the Sherpas, and never put anything back.
To try to get more control over their fate, many Sherpas are beginning to bypass climbing businesses to start their own expeditions. Their goal is to control the experience and keep themselves and climbers safe, if not comfortable, on a mountain they revere. Penelope Pulu, VOA News, Washington.
You can visit voanews.com for the in-depth video of this story. You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Jazz America.
This is Russ Davis, and on my program Jazz America, I carry on the tradition begun decades ago by the great Willis Conover by exploring the wonders of a century of jazz history. I'll cover it all from Dixieland to swing to bebop to modal, free jazz, fusion, world jazz, contemporary, and beyond. Plus, you'll hear the words of the artists themselves as they tell their incredible stories. Join me for Jazz America, Saturdays and Sundays at 13 hours Universal Time, online at voanews.com and the Voice of America.
I'm Victor Beatty. Since 1942, the Voice of America has been a consistently reliable and authoritative source of news. Today, VOA remains committed to providing an accurate, objective, and comprehensive news product at the top of every hour, every day. We can be heard on your local affiliate or streamed on the web at voanews.com.
This is VOA's International Edition. A Pennsylvania judge has ordered entertainer Bill Cosby to stand trial on charges that he molested a woman. The judge found that there is enough evidence to try Cosby on criminal charges. Kevin Steele is the Montgomery County, Pennsylvania district attorney.
The evidence in this case that was presented at the preliminary hearing is of a limited basis. A preliminary hearing is a situation where we only have to show that a crime's committed and the defendant's connected to the crime. We did that through the victim's statement and the defendant's admissions to much of the crime.
A 78-year-old Cosby could face 10 years in prison if convicted of sexually assaulting Andrea Constand. Her attorney, Gloria Allred, spoke to reporters after the preliminary hearing.
I think that Mr. Cosby's interview with the police in the police report that was admitted into evidence was very damaging to him.
Constand is a former basketball team manager at Temple University, Cosby's alma mater. She testified in the civil suit that she approached the comedian in 2004 for career advice. She says Cosby invited her to his home, gave her wine, and urged her to take 3 blue pills. The victim said she soon found herself unable to move or to speak. The case is the only criminal charge against Cosby, but he's also facing defamation, insurance lawsuits, and sex assaults in other states. More than 50 women say Cosby sexually assaulted them in incidents dating back to the 1960s. And that is going to do it for this edition of International Edition. We will be back tomorrow, same time, same place. You can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thanks so much for joining us, and thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Embassy in Yaoundé welcomed students from the International Marketing and Regional Integration Programs of the International Relations Institute of Cameroon, or IRIC, to the James Baldwin Information Resource Center, or IRC, to acquaint themselves with the functioning of the center and to have access to relevant sources for their academic research work. The James Baldwin Information Resource Center is a component of the Public Affairs section of the U.S. Embassy in Yaoundé. It is a public lending library for students, academia, and the general public, and a reference research center which provides comprehensive and authoritative information on the United States. Embassy Affairs Officer Roberto Quiroz II congratulated the students on their admission into such a prestigious institution as IRIC. "This is an effort the United States of America is proud to offer Cameroon in a support role," he said. "The real credit for all efforts go to Cameroon and Lake Chad Basin nations because they are leading all security efforts. All Cameroonians must be proud of how their sons and daughters in uniform have not hesitated to defend their homeland and fellow citizens against Boko Haram's attacks, which have victimized innocent civilians and targeted women and girls." Mr. Quiroz said Boko Haram will be defeated so that Cameroonians can build a future of peace and prosperity through their own talents and ideas. He also underscored other areas of partnership between both nations, including the protection of refugees fleeing violence, U.S. support for a vibrant civil society, growing private sector to create jobs and a free media, and joint efforts to protect wildlife. Mr. Quiroz also explained how diplomacy is an instrument of advancing good governance goals, adding that public perception of their performance as IRIC students and future diplomats and civil servants is very important as well. "Congratulations on your achievements," he told the students. "As future leaders in your fields, your first and foremost priority will be to advance the interests of Cameroon. That is a great responsibility. The United States is proud to work with its partner Cameroon for the benefit of both nations, the region, and Africa."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.